Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times each year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way. And in this latest issue, you get a little bit of pop-up as well. Scott Wampler was in the middle of writing up our experiences on the set of The Life of Chuck, Mike Flanagan's upcoming Stephen King adaptation. And we found that after he passed. And I helped that great team over there kind of fill some stuff in and get that written, get his final work out for everybody. I just got my copy. It's in a beautiful David Lynch tribute issue, and which is very appropriate for pop-up. This high quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to fangoria.com and sign up. Use the code KINGCAST at checkout to save a gigantic 25% off your order. That's fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. Mm-hmm. Today, we induct yet another guest into our two-timers club. That actually sounds kind of bad. You're not a two-timer, Chris. We
two-timing Christopher Landon.
I kind of like it.
Chris was last on our show around the release of his film, We Have a Ghost, in 2023. We talked about 11/22/63, I believe. We also know him as the writer-director behind Freaky and the Happy Death Day films, the writer of a huge chunk of the Paranormal Activities, the co-writer of the recent surprise hit Hard Eyes. He has a new film about to theaters called Drop. If you've seen a movie in the last 3 months, odds are you've seen this trailer. It's an old-school, high-concept thriller starring Megan Fahey and Brendan Sklenar. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You're the first person to say it right.
God, what are they damn, just say? Knocking it out of the park. Look at this, kicking off April.
He would kiss you right now.
Is it usually like Skleener? Everyone
says Sklenar. You know? Huh. Oh.
That sounds like a very Texas way of pronouncing
it. It is very Texas. So, you know?
You're a local boy. We'll dig into that and you know how we love to mispronounce things just for the fuck of it here in Texas. Well, the movie's about a very stressful first date. We can say that much. We'll talk a little bit about that movie and then jump into some chit chat about Stephen King's The Mist. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Christopher Landon back to the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, everybody. Happy to be back. Very happy.
Two-timing Christopher Landon.
Two-timing. Stupid piece of shit, Landon.
Now, Anthony, you were saying right before we were recording that, the pairing of the topics of the drop in the mist. I almost called it the drop. I'm sorry. Drop in the mist. There's some parallels there where, you're way more observant than I am, I think, Anthony, because I was sitting here going, man, maybe I should have, suggested The Ledge. Or something, even though Drop,
has multiple meanings.
It does. It's in reference mostly to getting a file dropped on, randomly onto your cell phone. But, the restaurant's very high up. And I think if you've seen the trailer, there's a little Vertigo-esque things. You can't set it's Chekhov's high restaurant, I guess. you can't set a thriller in this super off the ground restaurant and not expect there to be somebody dangling off the side at some point.
Yeah. Well, we should set up the movie for those who, like you said, that trailer is all over the place. And so people are probably familiar with it, but it's about a woman who goes on a date with a very handsome fellow. And she keeps getting ominous messages on her phone that say, basically, I'm ordering her to do various deeds that seem impossible and immoral and illegal. But the interesting thing about it is it's not just coming from far away. It has to be somebody. The premise of Drop is that there has to be somebody close enough to your phone to be dropping these messages on you. So Christopher, is there anything we should add to that description? She's trying to figure out who in her vicinity
Yeah, I think it's a fair
is ready.
description. I think it's a she is both trying to solve a mystery of who is tormenting her and controlling her, while also trying to figure out how can I keep my date alive.
What I love are the moments where she'll get a message and there'll be a little exchange, and then she'll quickly glance around the restaurant and everybody is on their phone all the time, which is a real phenomenon from real life that you've captured. Nobody is just staring off into space.
Oh,
Everybody's
everyone's. And that was the whole, it's the reason why I got so excited about the movie and the concept, just because most movies tend to kind of avoid technology. They don't, most everyone's kind of annoyed having to do phone inserts and deal with phones and whatnot. And nowadays, it's funny, like when you make a thriller or a horror movie, everybody always gets to the part where, like, but why don't they just call the cops, you know, or whatever? So, like, technology has become such a pain in the ass to deal with. But in this case, it becomes the weapon,
the vehicle
it
of the
becomes the
thriller.
evil. And so it's an inversion, I think, of that, which is a lot of fun.
And the connection I made that Eric kindly praised me for was you've chosen The Mist today, which is another story about a group of people in a closed space. That's more of an ensemble because there's all this interaction between the different characters. But in this case, she's trying to figure out who could it be the bartender? Could it be the piano player? Could it be the couple next in the table next door? Is it the waiter, the great waiter who brings a lot of comic relief to this story? But the Mist, it's not a whodunit, but it's a similar story of a group of strangers trapped together, trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. And I think that's pretty much where the parallels, where the
Well,
stories
maybe
diverge.
they got some calamari, didn't they? So there's some tentacles or
That's
something. But
right. That's good. That's good.
Yeah, but
Did
both are,
you?
I see where you mean though, because both are microcosms. Like you get, you know, this group together, and this goes back to, you know, you can think of Lord of the Flies or whatever. It's like once you have a certain group together, now nobody else knows that they're in a thriller that's in this restaurant except for me, the perpetrator. But you do see these like little, I don't know, this little society that's happening. You know, I don't know. It's weird. When you get a focus on a group of people in one isolated place, whether or not it's cliques or just people going about their life, it's weird. These little islands of the, you know, the breakdowns of humanity and government and shit just start popping up. I think I'm reading too deep into this, but you know, but I think that that's part of you know, how good of a job you did in like making this like just a realistic microcosm of different kinds of people in the restaurant.
Yeah, and I think that's something that the novella does well and the movie does really well, is that it gives you, because this is the reality, like we all live in our little social bubbles, especially now, I think more than ever. But we still have to sort of push ourselves out into the world, and we end up in these different places where we are exposed to different kinds of people. And sometimes we can be trapped with those people. And then you start to learn how they tick, and who they really are and what they really believe in. And I think one of the fun things about Drop was, yeah, getting to, I worked very closely with the writers first in terms of sort of populating the space with people that the audience would really recognize. And that's another thing that I think The Mist does really well. It's like, you know those people, even though they are characters in something else, but you've encountered those people at
You
some
mean
point.
like recognize as types, not recognize the actor or the faces
Yeah,
of it.
exactly. You recognize that type of person, you know, and that's part of the fun of it. But even like in our case, like even background actors, like we built little stories about every table so that we could really kind of find a very specific kind of person. And so we cast all of the background as well, as opposed to like doing a cattle call and just sending a group of people through wardrobe and pushing them into a room. Like I went through dozens of books and looked at specific people and handpicked every person that's in the restaurant and made a story out of every table. Because otherwise it would feel like you had just had a bunch of extras, like who are hapless. And so I didn't want that, because you do want to populate the world with people of suspicion. And so however big or small a role might be, I wanted people to wonder, like, well, who is it? Could it be that person? Are they throwing this away? Are they burying the person? Are we finding them in a different way? Are they a more like present person? So it was very deliberate, and specific. And like I said, one of my favorite things about all of Stephen King's books is that I always know the people when I meet them in the book. I don't know. It just feels, they feel immediately familiar. And even if he takes them somewhere different, there's just an immediate sense of person, like, I know you.
Yeah, there's it's real people in extraordinary circumstances, whether even in his dramatic work, you recognize, just they at the time of this recording, they just dropped the new tray or the new poster for The Life of Chuck, and it's like, and it just struck me as like, yeah, when reading that novella, it's like, you recognize Chuck, even though that's a narrative told in reverse. It's like all this crazy shit's happening. There's an end of the world happening. There's, like all this crazy shit's happening, but you recognize this kind of meek guy at the center of it,
And that grounds it. And that's what he's so good at. He's good at throwing ordinary people into extraordinary circumstances. And I think that's, again, another sort of parallel with Drop. You know, like, this is a mom, going on a first date, which is also, I think, something that a lot of women out there can relate to. It's a really difficult, and vulnerable thing to do, when you come out of a bad relationship and you are trying to mend yourself somehow. And part of that is like trying to figure out if you can find romantic love again. And then of course shit goes south.
Do
It
you
reminds you, maybe you should have stayed home.
Yeah, well, I'm off the market now, but I was doing online dating and stuff for a long time, and it sucks, man. Like, fucking dating sucks.
Dating is
It
awful.
really does. It's terrible. Everybody's vulnerable. Nobody's ever it doesn't ever seem to be on the same page about anything. I don't know. It's there's a weird thing about putting your inauthentic self out there too, and I think that's one of the interesting things is you establish and drop that that these two that are dating, they're meeting for the first time, but there's been months of lead up to this as she's getting ready for it, and so they do have a connection and there is a spark there, and I that's not something that I think can happen if they just like hit up each other on Okay, Cupid, two days before and said, all right, let's grab a drink somewhere,
But what's really fun about that too is, and watching, when we were making the film and when I was talking to the actors, even though they had this sort of like history that was very sort of like a text, really a text-driven history, but with the occasional call and whatnot, they still arrive at the date really nervous. And to me, that's also the most, that's, and I actually think those nerves really do come on heavy when you genuinely like somebody and you're meeting them in person for the first time. And so that was a really important aspect, I think, of the.
You have a psycho who's airdropping to her, but in addition to that aspect of the thriller, I thought Drop was really tense because the date is going so badly. Like that started stressing me out.
Yes, it
Because
does.
she's getting these airdrops and she's not able to tell him. Like if she, I don't think this gives anything away, but the person threatening her is like, something bad is going to happen to your child if you tell anyone. So she can't even say, I'm sorry, I'm getting tormented by a psycho. She has to sort of
No,
keep a
she has to
straight face.
perform. She has to give the performance of her life
But she
and
also has to
try
keep
and
checking her phone
And
and
she's
he's
also like doing a million weird things that she has to try to excuse away, that he also has to try to accept because he likes her. But like, should he go? What's happening?
I mean, there's a moment again. I hope this isn't giving away too much, but where he's ready to go, like, okay, you seem to have a lot going
Don't
on.
spoil
But I'm gonna,
it.
he comes close to just parting ways, and I could see why. Was that a hard part of the structure of the story of keeping them together when she's so obviously distracted? Like you have to create some sort of bond so that this guy doesn't go, all right, you're crazy, I'm out of here.
It was, and in fact, when I in an early the first draft, because I when the producers brought the project to me, I read Chris and Jill's very first draft, and had it was very different from the movie that it is now. And one of the big differences is that Henry, who is the date, he kind of just sat there and took it. And so that was like my first big note. I was like, this guy's a total drip. Like, he's a dish rag. So we've got to like, we've got to figure some of this stuff out and figure out how to make him more of a fully realized human being who is rational and would probably pull the plug on a date like this.
Yeah.
If it have certain things happening. And if he also, and it was something that I talked a lot with Brandon about, which was that beyond some of the clever things that happen that hopefully keep him on the date and some of the ways that she is very much manipulating him, the sort of, I always like to, you know, it's like kind of corny directing stuff, but like, you do like to give an actor a secret sometimes. And so for him, I said, you know, I think on a very deep gut level, he knows something very bad is happening to this woman, and he is trying to see it through and kind of wait it out a little bit. And he's kind of, because he just has a spidey sense. So that gave him another little layer to play. And also, you know, it's fun because there's some suspicion that we also cast on him as a character. Mm-hmm. He's not, that was another thing that I developed with the writers, was like, how squeaky clean is this guy? Mm-hmm. So let's add a little more there. So that was like some stuff that we really did have to work on. Yeah. Otherwise, like I think, and I don't know if you've been on, I've been on a date where I left. I was literally on a date where I excused myself to go to the restroom. I paid the bill and I snuck out the back.
Oh no.
Oh wow. Yes. That's
bad. It was that bad.
I haven't dated for a long time. I've been married for couple of decades now, but I have been out with friends who keep checking their phones or like super distracted by something, and it is kind of maddening. And I've also been the friend. Like, there was a time in my life, I think, when I was really social media addicted, and I'm like, you know, I've had friends go, can you get off your phone? And they're right. And they're right. Yeah. Like, that's a terrible thing. Like, you're not living your life. You're not being present. And I thought,
it's an appendage now, you know, like this thing that we carry around, and it's hard to detach from it or put it away. And it's also hard for us to like exist in a world where like, we used to be okay with not worrying about work or worrying about, and now we have this thing where, and there's an expectation, I think, for a lot of people too, whether it's, I mean, on a, like a weekday, like if you meet a friend for dinner, like we're still checking emails, work emails and shit. And it's also because like, it's expected, like on the other side too, like people that we work for expect us to do it now. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no time off.
Yeah.
You know, it's really weird. And we used to exist in a world where that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You left the office and
it was done. Yeah. You're nine to five. And after five, it was all your.
That was it. They were calling you at home like, Frank, you know?
Or they were like, you know, if they did get you at home, it was a real emergency. It wasn't just, doing this now.
Yeah, I saw somebody recently was talking about the psychology of all that and how maybe, you know, that, you know, I guess there are some studies that have been done that have shown that like human beings are just like 100 times more anxious than they were 20 years ago. You know, it's like they somehow quantified it. I don't know the science about it. It might be bullshit, but I certainly feel real in my lived experience. But the talk about it was like, that's right, because 20 years ago, nobody was on call 24/7.
Right.
And, you know, unless you happen to be the top surgeon in your field or something, right? And I mean, it's like, that's.
And nobody had to market themselves.
Yeah. And everybody, everything, you know, is all about social media, or it's about, you know, whatever your business is, no matter what you're doing, the expectation now is completely changed, where you have to be available whenever somebody needs something from you. And that takes a toll on people.
Yeah.
This notion of Henry not being a drip, and he's got to go like, what's going on, and then accept that he maybe can't figure that out. I mean, that's typical of almost every story. Is there's a, you hit a point where there's like a hole in the plot, like a logic flaw that you've got to solve. It's like a math problem you have to solve to keep going and hold it all together. And King does that too with The Mist. I think that's another parallel, except he has a big enough cast that he can send people out. Like, why wouldn't they just walk out and leave? And some of them do and get bitten in half. And then they pull, you know, so it's like he is able to test like the Velociraptor in Jurassic Park, like test the line for flaws by actually having his characters walk out into the Lovecraftian buzzsaw of his monsters. But were there any other things that you had to do in Drop that were like that? Like, okay, we're gonna hit a this is in the real world, this is what somebody would do. So we've got to figure out why that doesn't happen or why that doesn't
Yes, I
derail
mean,
the
it was a
story.
lot. There was a lot of that. And again, I think when I was working with the writers, I kept adding attempts to reach the outside world somehow, because I thought if I'm a mother and I'm also being tasked with to murder someone, because like, the reality of that is like if you kill someone, like you're going to be separated from your child. Like also not a reasonable situation to be in. And so I kept thinking about like what are all the ways that she would try to communicate with someone to try and get someone to sort of help her. And so that was another sort of area that we had to work on.
And you have to do it, and by the way, I want to stress this in a way that's not wholly unrealistic for the perpetrator to have countered, right? So you can't just have, this isn't like a James Bond scene where the head of Spectre could, have an eye or a microphone in every corner of the place. You know what I mean? It's like you have to do it in a way that's believable that this could be a situation you might find yourself in,
Absolutely. I'll put it this way. In the OG draft, the first draft, there was a completely different villain with a very different what's the word? So a very
Motivation.
yes, a very different motivation. Thank you. The word is just gone. And so I just felt like there was a lot of stuff that had to be managed and wrangled. It's hard to talk about the movie and not give away
Oh, of
stuff.
course.
So I'm trying to like figure out how do I talk about this thing without fucking this up and ruining it for everybody. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. And then there was just other stuff, structure stuff, things that, the first draft ended in the restaurant. There was no other part to the movie at all.
Interesting.
That was a big change. So yeah, there was a lot to manage, but that's every movie. But one thing I will say is that I will never try to figure those things out while we're filming. Like if I don't, I really, for my own peace of mind making a film, I need to have everything pretty airtight, like at least 95% airtight. Doesn't mean that there won't be some adjustments and changes to the script. Sometimes things pop up or you lose a location or something goes awry, but like I despise the idea of trying to wing it and figure things
Oh,
out.
right.
So I think that's like a bad, bad, bad thing to do.
Well, in that spirit, let's do a little bit of an experiment here. Say that you are now tasked with doing a Stephen King missed Drop crossover. So Drop Part Two, you have the all the characters from the Mist are now the suspects here. Who do you place and where? Like who do you make the villain? Who do you make the people at the forefront of it? It doesn't have to be a date. It could be, a father-son outing with what's his name? David and his kid,
And I mean, and who is the villain now?
Like who do you make the perpetrator of this? Who's the
Oh,
unlikely ally? Who's the red herring?
right. I don't honestly, I feel like not much would change in
Yeah.
that regard.
Well,
Sorry.
I feel like Miss Carmody is just too obvious to be the,
Yeah, but you would disguise that, or you would lean into it because she is so obviously fucking loony that like the audience cancel her out. Like that's the thing is
Yeah.
that you start to
They're
kind of
like, oh, it
like
must be her. She must be the
sometimes you
bad
have
guy.
to double down on the person because it's a funny thing where like the audience becomes so suspicious of a character. There's a journey that happens when you're doing like a whodunit where the audience is like, oh, it can't be her. She's too fucking crazy. But then they double back and they're like, but could it? Because she remembers. And then they go back to like, but no, it couldn't. So it's funny how like if you create if there are enough characters who you are kind of if you throw in enough red herrings, I guess, at the audience, they're going to start to get. It's kind of like it's like Trump signing executive orders. Quickly, it's like you just throw them, you just spray and pray.
Well, the I will say on that note, and I'm not letting you off the hook. You still have to pick some people here, but
oh god, this is too hard.
But I think watching Murder, She Wrote and Columbo and shit with my grandparents growing up really fucking ruined me for most whodunits, because when you're a kid and you start to notice the patterns,
you get good at it.
You get good at it. And like, listen, when you're a movie geek or something and you get to a certain age, you start going, well, they're not going to cast this well-known person to say one line in the first 5 minutes and then disappear for the rest of the episode. So of course that's got to be the person, but usually that's who it is. It's like the secret to, I'd say, just an average whodunit is to look at the person that's the least likely, and it's always that person. Right. So I get what you're saying, that it is fun when you play with the suspicions, where you can do somebody who is more obvious, you know, the butler did it or whatever, and you're like, well, it couldn't be that obvious, you know, and you know, obviously this other person looks more suspicious now.
So in this version of Drop, like for example, you would make like Ollie Weeks a waiter who is working on his last day because he's been fired.
Oh, okay. Love it.
Because he's just kind of a hapless, bumbling guy who's just doesn't fit into this world. And it sucks for him because like he had this whole other career in mind, and somehow he still landed up in the service industry late in life, and he's really bummed out about it, you know, and it's just not clicking. And then suddenly he becomes suspicious of something that might be happening in the audience, might suddenly kind of glom onto him to be like, he's going to be the ally who's going to help. But then again, could he be the most suspicious person because of that?
Right. You know? And he turns around and they see the gun like in his back pocket, and you're just like, why does our waiter have a gun? It just turns out.
Why does he have a gun? And then you find out it's a water gun.
Yes.
And it's part of the restaurant. They do a funny bit when it's a birthday and they spray the candle. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's the fun of it, is that you get to, you know, you get to play around with that kind of stuff.
I don't want it to seem like Eric and I are like pitching you on a sequel to the Myst themed sequel to Drop. But my personal feeling is you flip the good guys and the bad guys. You know, you've got David Drayton trying to manipulate Mrs. Carmody by airdropping her messages from Jesus Christ. She would definitely, definitely listen. You know, it's like Jesus is telling you to do this.
But only if we still get Marcia Gay Harden to play the part. That's kind of
Tom Jane, of course, he's sitting in the corner smoking a cigar the whole time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, he got recast. I'm sorry.
Oh we can't
it's
go.
Hollywood. It's Hollywood. They wanted Glenn Powell.
Wanted Glenn Powell. They needed the
they
character
wanted a
to wear
really
shoes.
Sexy dad.
They needed the character dad to wear shoes, and he wouldn't do it. So yeah, I get it.
And he has a daughter.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a situation like a Stephen King biodome? The Mist, the Langoliers, I think Under the Dome is a literal example of this. Like, characters are trapped together and they've got to work it out. Some are antagonists, some are protagonists, some form alliances, some are weak links. But have you ever been in a situation like that in real life?
Besides an escape room?
Yeah, like,
because I have done that, and and I was in one escape room in particular where we had to work with, I went with my family, and we ended up in the room with another family, and they were really dumb.
Oh, that's the worst when you're in with randos that don't know what the fuck they're doing. Yeah.
They didn't know what the fuck they were doing, and it was high stakes because this escape room was so fucking scary, because you go in and you're in this big room that's like ornately furnished, you know, and it's quite large. And then at the back end of the room is this large armoire, and then there's a light above it. And then when the game began, we're kind of like walking around like, oh, okay, what are we supposed to do here? I didn't know anything about this thing. And then all of a sudden the light went off with this loud buzzing sound, and the armoire doors burst open and a zombie jumped out, and like a dude in like full zombie makeup with a chain collar around his throat.
and he kind of only had so much slack, and so he was stuck, so he couldn't reach you. But every 5 minutes, as you search for clues, his chain gets longer. And so that he can eventually, by the end of the game, because the dodos that we were in there with kept fucking it up for us, so we had like half the manpower to solve. At a certain point, he's just eating everybody. Like if he touched you, you were dead.
He tags you out.
So you're trying to solve shit while you're jumping over tables because this guy can grab you. It was so high. It was the most stressful thing in the world. And yes, and so we didn't, we actually did survive. Some of us, not all of us. that other family, the whole family died.
did you push them? They're like, that would have been me. It's just like, oh, you should check this clue over them, here, and then kind of nudge them into the zombie.
Yeah, I'm definitely a human shield kind of guy.
That's so. What's your relationship with this with the Mist? Is it something that you first discovered via the novella? Did you read it first?
Yes, I read it first. Funny enough, a bazillion years ago, when I was a kid, and my mom, I had an aunt that lived in San Francisco. We lived in Los Angeles, and 1 year, my mom decided that we would take the train to Oakland. That's where the train went from LA to Oakland. And so I brought the book with me. I brought the novella with me. And I actually didn't think, and I'm trying to think of how old I was. I was probably like 12, I want to say, 12 or 13. And I remember when I got on the train and started reading it, I was like, oh, I was kind of bummed because I thought I'm never going to finish this.
Yeah, it's a long one. Long one. It's top heavy, that Skeleton Crew collection.
Yes. And so I didn't think I could finish it. But then, this is a true story and very dark, halfway to Oakland, our train hit somebody.
Jesus. Okay.
A man who was on the tracks and killed him. And so we had to stop and they kept us on the train because we were in the middle of nowhere. It's not like you could get out and walk somewhere or whatever. Right. And so they kept us in one place for about 5 hours. And it's already an 8 hour train ride, I think. So I had a lot of time in the end and read the whole thing. And it scared the shit out of me. And I loved it. And I also remember like having to kind of lie about what I was reading because my mom was very like conservative and religious and kind of was uncomfortable with my obsession with horror. And so she wasn't paying much attention to what it was, but she kept asking me like, oh, is your book good? And I'm like, yeah, it's okay. And inside I'm like, oh my God.
What's your story about? Oh, it's about a religious woman at a grocery store making new friends. It
was like but the funny part was, is that my mom was very religious. And I saw the parallels with Mrs. Carmen. Like, oh my God, like, because my mom was the kind of person that would do like contraband searches of my room and look for anything that she deemed satanic. And she would destroy it. Like literally burn shit, like, or break it with a hammer. It was kind of over the top crazy stuff that was really weird. And she always like replaced them with nice things as she saw that fit, you know, like things she deemed worthy. So yeah, reading that character and that story and everything really, I didn't think my mom was evil, that she was capable of those things, but I certainly saw how
strident she could be, right?
I just saw how a certain kind of zealotry can poison someone.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and can sort of misdirect them. And
leave them. You said she replaced things. You mean like she'd like smash a Black Sabbath album and then replace it with the Care Bears or something?
Yeah, something like, yeah, she would. She would. It was mostly like things like that were books she didn't replace. Like she just would just say, go to the library and get a real book. And it was video games. The video games she would destroy, and then she would let me buy a replacement as long as it was acceptable.
Like Mortal Kombat and stuff. And like, I remember that was like,
it's funny. Like it wasn't even so much that too. It was like, I remember like, fuck, was it Castlevania or.
Right.
Like, okay.
The occult,
there
right?
There was like, I remember one of the games, I can't remember if it was Castlevania or another one, but the game began with like a little story and there was a princess and then like a winged demon flew down and grabbed her and picked her up and took her off. Right. And my mom,
I think that's canceled. That sounds like Castlevania.
It was Castlevania. And I remember my mom like feeling her standing behind me and she just walked over and like hit the button and pulled the game out. And I was like, okay, well, there's a demon in it.
Is your mom still around today?
No. She passed away. Oh gosh, no, about 10 years ago. And by the way, like it was a phase for her. That kind of extreme religious kind of fervor. She was sort of peaking around that time, unfortunately, at a very formative time when I was really into the like figuring these things out. And then she kind of got past it. It's she remained religious and a Christian, but she kind of like eased off the gas and like kind of mellowed out and wasn't so and then came to really embrace the things that I loved.
Well, that's great. Yeah, because that was what I was going to go with it, because there was I mean, that period of time, I think you're just a smidge older than I am. I'm an 81 baby. So, but I remember the Satanic Panic stuff. And I remember that very clearly. And it's so funny to think about, time-wise now. I feel like I'm getting old, but like I also go, it wasn't that long ago when churches were burning copies of Harry Potter. You know what I mean? It's like
I mean, they're
it
still at it. They're just doing it differently.
well, it's weird. Are they? 'Cause it just feels like there
Like,
is
you know how many banned books there are now?
well, the, I mean, yes. I mean, there's a rise in
The
conservatism
same,
for
that's the
sure.
same thing. But that is the same thing. Like that kind of conservatism comes from an extreme kind of religion. You know what I mean? Like that believes that like there is no separation between church and state. That's why they've got their hands in places that they don't belong. And yeah, I mean, I had a front row seat to that kind of thought. And it was weird because my dad, who was also alive then, and my parents were divorced, was the opposite. He was the one feeding it all to me. He was the one getting me the books and letting me rent all the horror movies. And it was like almost in a funny way, just more of an extended version of their battle with each other too. Like the fight between, as she saw it, maybe good and evil. I don't know. But it was messy, but it didn't change anything. Heart wants what it wants.
It does. By the way, wasn't Castlevania, when you were talking about that game, it rang a bell. That would be Ghosts and Goblins. The opening where they're having a picnic.
This is it. Oh my God, this is it. Oh my God, I remember this. Oh God. Yeah. I don't know how
Very.
that's going to play in a podcast,
I
but there's a
know,
little
but it's
demon who
fucking
appears in the
rad.
sky, snatches the woman, the little princess, up from her picnic, and then the guy puts on a suit of armor and runs into battle against zombies, none of whom have a chain around their neck.
Well, I don't know, like, because I'm of two minds about this, because I grew up in a very liberal household. So I grew up there was almost never a restriction on R-rated movies. I could read, like, I read Stephen King because my mom was reading Stephen King. And so, I felt like I was allowed to go explore and find the things that I love and dive headfirst into it. But there's also some truth to the forbiddenness of things, like really hooking you. Because I remember there were only a couple of movies that my mom got weird about me watching. And it's considering I was like just mainlining Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street movies, on the daily. It's weird that it's these two movies, but she got weird about two of them, and they were both on the same cassette that we recorded off of HBO. It was on the same VHS tape. And one of them was The Fly, Cronenberg's The Fly, and the other one was Aliens. And both of the and but and Aliens is like the most like tame when you consider like
It's so
gore
tame. There's
and
no
sex,
nudity.
and yeah, it's
There's
like
no sex. There's no, like, I
I
remember
don't
the
know.
scene.
There's a little bit. There's a little bit of that. She's running around that little tank top and
I mean, it's a
underwear.
tank top, though. I'm
It's
talking about,
close.
like,
I
I
mean, like,
remember,
yeah.
like,
Well,
my dad, who did open the gates and say, okay, go ahead, you can rent. And so my sister and I both were watching a shit ton of like Halloween and everything. But there were a few movies that he flagged and said, these are forbidden, at least for now. And
Cannibal
the last,
Holocaust.
no, it was I Spit on Your Grave and Maniac.
Oh, okay. Well,
And
those are
those
two
were,
pretty extreme movies. I get
they
it.
were. And so at least he kind of, that was where he drew The Line. And of course, those were the two movies that my sister and I both were like obsessed with. So like,
Well,
even
there you
though
go.
we couldn't rent it, every time we went to the video store, those were the first two VHS covers that we grabbed to
That's
like
forbidden fruit. Yeah,
Forbidden
right.
Fruit.
Do you
Forbidden
think
Fruit.
he was permissive because he understood that by saying no, that that would make it more tempting? Or was he, did he just trust you and your maturity level? Because I try to be the same kind of dad. Like, if my kids want to watch something, generally okay, except if I know they're too young for it and won't really get it or might be disturbed by it, I'll warn them away. But generally, if they feel like they really want to see something, I'm inclined to let them try. Do you think he was trying, he just trusted you and knew your maturity level? Or do you think he was like, all right, let's, was it like a Smoke Up Johnny situation? Like, all right, go ahead, watch these horror films. And when you can't sleep at night, you're on your own, kid.
I wish that I could ask him that.
Yeah.
Because
Oh.
I do wonder sometimes, like, why he let us suddenly do it. It wasn't immediate. Like we went from like watching like The Ghost of Mr. Chicken to like Texas Chainsaw. So it was kind of an extreme jump from Disney to death.
Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi gummies has a strain that's right for you. Now, I walk the walk when it comes to my Lumi gummies. I'm a loyal customer and indeed just placed an order to restock my wares earlier this week. I went with my favorites, the orange cream cookie sativa gummies. If I take one of these bad boys before bed, I'm out like a light in less than an hour. Lumi gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com. That's Lumi gummies and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. Again, that's LUMIGummies.com, code KINGCAST. Now let's get back to the show.
Can we talk about who he is, who he was? Is that all
Sure.
right?
Yeah, that's fine. That's totally
Michael
fine.
Landon, the actor Michael Landon, right? And who made a lot of very wholesome things, Little House on the Prairie, Highway to Heaven. I mean, he was when you said open the gates, I was like,
I mean, and I will say that your dad scared the fuck out of me because, that Highway to Heaven was done in that time period where every Halloween there would be a great Halloween episode, no matter what
Totally.
television was. And I wasn't used to that. I would watch Highway to Heaven with my grandparents or whatever, right? Just as that show. And
Sure.
then the Halloween one does an homage to, an earlier role of his with I Was a Teenage Werewolf and turns into a werewolf.
All
And it
right.
scared the living shit out of me.
That's really funny.
It's like he's just the nice guy on TV and suddenly he's got fangs. So yeah. Just
I
want to throw that
think
out there.
it's good.
Is he mentioned in It by name? Because
I don't
isn't the
know.
teenage werewolf
Yeah, I
like one
mean,
of the things they're afraid
the
of
role is,
in
yeah, that's what
I
Pennywise
don't
takes
think
the
he's
form
mentioned
of to
by
scare Richie.
I
Yeah.
don't think
Yeah.
he's mentioned by name though.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's the other funny thing is that he had this very, obviously a very wholesome persona, and had this kind of career, and but he loved horror movies. He watched a lot of these with us. And he always would sort of muse that, like, oh, I wish I could make one. It would be so fun to make a horror movie. And I would ask him, like, well, why can't you? And he's like, well, no one would ever let me. And so I've always said that a huge part of my whole career, I think, was sort of like I created this alter ego where he could. And so I really, that was where my love for it was born. It was a combination of like, yes, I get to see these things that are kind of forbidden and scary, but also like I got to do that with him. It was like our thing. And so that's what made it, I think, special. It was like a weird, fucked up kind of family time. But I still don't fully understand why he just thought, oh, it's okay for a 7-year-old to see Friday the 13th. Because I was terrified. Like I could not. I would sleep every night in my bed and pull my covers completely over my head and make just the tiniest air hole so I could survive. because I was so scared of what was going to crawl out of my closet or under my bed or whatever.
Right.
But I ran back to it every weekend. I wanted more and more and more. But I do think a lot of it had to do with him. Like I said, he was in this bitter divorce with my mom, and it was a long custody battle. And I really think that he just wanted to be like the cool dad that like let us do all the fun stuff, because it made us not want to be around her.
Yeah. I see. It's interesting, because there's some parallels here with we had Osgood Perkins on to talk about the monkey, and he and his, you know, very famous father had a bond over genre as well. And I have fond memories of it's so weird though, because I have a brother, but he was born after I was like 10, so I was 10 when he was born. Mm-hmm. So there's a big generation gap, right? And for 10 years I was an only child, and for 10 years of being an only child, 7 of those my mom was a single mom, and then like, you know, she met my stepdad and that started it. But my memory is that like I was such a latchkey kid, you know, like the tail end of that Gen X. Yeah, I'm an elder millennial, I guess, technically, but I was at the tail end of all that stuff where, you know, as long as I was home, they didn't give a fuck, right? Mm-hmm. What I was doing. If I was up in my room, if I, you know, I had a trackpad. Do you remember that for like the Nintendo, where you could like, you would like plug it into your Nintendo and then you would roll it out and you would like, it would have the numbers and stuff, and you would like do like the Olympic games and you would do the long jumps and all that. That was the only thing I did in my room that they didn't like, because I was on the second story of
You would bang and
bang and they're just like, shut the fuck up. But like, essentially, it was just like, oh, cool, you're awake. Are you fed? Cool. Do what you're going to do. Totally. Watch whatever you're going to watch.
Parenting was so different. It was so different back then. Like, I really think about like how little I saw of my parents sometimes at home when we were all home together. Just kind of funny how as parents now, you know, I have two kids. I don't believe in like helicopter crazy parenting, you know. I do try to give them some slack and stuff, but it is still, I'm way more up in their shit than my parents ever were.
Right. Well, I grew up in the Bay Area, and there was a theme park that was the kind of close to us called Great America. Different companies owned it throughout the years. I think Paramount owned it for a good chunk of my childhood. And I remember they had like the Wayne's World car like parked out there. That's where they shot Beverly Hills Cop 3. So that really terrible John Landis Beverly Hills Cop movie. But that was shot at Great America, and that was my local theme park. And it's insane to me to think about like how my mom would like over summers, we would get an annual pass, and she would go, okay, the bus at the front of our apartment complex goes directly to Great America and comes back. And I was like 9, and she would just say, you know, just make sure you're back before midnight, you know, kind of thing. And I would get on a bus, you know, in, you know, this is in Sunnyvale, California, get on a bus, take it like an hour and a half to the theme park, drops me off at the theme park. I would go just ride whatever I could ride. And then just on my own, like nine and 10 years old, you know, on my own, I would come back and find the bus, get on the bus and take it right back to my apartment. And
100%. I was watching E.T. the other night with my kids had never seen E.T. And there's a scene where like, you know, mom, she leaves Gertie alone.
Yeah.
To go pick up Elliot. And Gertie she's like 5.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'll be back really quick, honey. I just went into the pool. And I was like, and I feel like nobody blinked when that movie came out. Like nobody cared. And then as I sat there watching it, I went, oh my God, she's so irresponsible.
Child Protective Services is coming for
this
mom.
This beloved mother from my childhood is an irresponsible parent. But yeah, it was kind of funny how it's all changed.
That is funny. That is how times change. But isn't that what everybody's striving for, right? Like, is this notion of like getting your kids back to a sense of that independence, of the kind of kid you read in a Stephen King story who gets to ride his bike around and explore and discover monsters and
fight killer clowns and
you know.
I mean, it's why I expose my kids. Like I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. And I have a little acronym I call TOT, which is Touch of Terror. And I believe a little touch of terror is really good for them. And so I'm always kind of stress testing where that is, but like they've seen Beetlejuice and they've seen Gremlins.
Yeah.
They've seen the new Beetlejuice. And so I'm exposing them to stuff gradually. I'm not doing what my dad did, which is like, you know, let's get straight to the R-rated beheadings.
Right.
But I do think I'm beginning to develop a relationship with death and fear and all those things is really healthy.
It is healthy. I agree with you. I think that's good parenting. Yeah. And also, when you grow up, you look back at those things that scared you but didn't hurt you. Like if you think of a car crash or something that you got in that may maybe hurt somebody, you're still traumatized by that. But the monster, I remember watching V on television. You remember the alien invasion thing and the little alien baby that the woman has?
God, I was terrified. Obsessed with the what was her name, Mike? The villain, the woman with the
Diana.
Diana, I was obsessed with her. I think that was when I really started to come out.
Yeah.
Like, she is fierce. I want to be her.
She is.
I remember she always had glitter in her fucking hair.
Yeah.
It was full on.
She was 80s great. Or alien, you know, you couldn't tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, yeah. Exactly. Well, while we were talking, Christopher, I did a quick search of the text of it, and your dad, Michael Landon, is mentioned by name twice.
It is. Oh, shit.
Page 343 and then page 383. And
he read through the entire book, by the way.
Yeah, like, I read the whole thing while we were
Johnny Five.
But the reason reason I was like, I think they mentioned him by name is because I remember the funny description. And it says, quote, one of the monsters was a werewolf played by Michael Landon. And he was cool because even when he was the werewolf, he still had a duck's ass haircut.
That's so funny. I completely forgot about that.
So he got a shot. It's cool that he was a horror fan. Good. I wonder if he ever knew about this.
I don't know.
If you could be name dropped in a Stephen King novel, let alone one as iconic as it, come on.
I mean, my dad has had a couple iconic name checks. I think my favorite one, there was a South Park episode where they go to hell and my dad was in hell. I remember
for letting his kids watch all those scary ass movies.
I remember bursting out laughing, seeing a cartoon version of my dad on South Park in hell.
Is that from the movie whenever Kenny goes to hell and it's like Gandhi and like all these people? Because the whole joke there is like heaven has a population of like 94 and everybody else is in hell.
Exactly.
That's funny. So speaking of hell, and let's talk a little bit about The Mist. Let's jump back into that arena. This was a story I was obsessed with when I was a kid. This is something I've talked at length about on the show, so I won't go into too much detail. But like, I used the story to help me learn typing. Like, I transcribed that story. You know, I had my reference up because back in the day, that's what you did. This is before everybody had a computer in their house. So I was learning to type on a typewriter. And I was probably the last class, maybe the last year of school to actually do it that way. But because Apple IIe's and shit were around at that point. That's what I did, is like I was just kind of obsessed with taking the words of Stephen King and writing them verbatim, like myself, and like it kind of forced me to examine the text more closely.
I was going to ask you that. Did you see things you didn't see before
I think I definitely did, because what I remember clocking at that point was going, oh, I skim read a lot. Because I'm a very slow reader, and I think that what can happen with me is my attention can kind of wander a little bit. And if I'm not right in the moment, sometimes I will be reading it and then realize I get to the end of a paragraph and I didn't retain a goddamn thing about it. And so I'd have to go back. And what that did is it like made me recognize that about myself. So I'm much better about doing that now. I'm still the world's slowest reader, by the way.
I think ideally you get swept along by the narrative and you forget you're reading, even though you are retaining the information. I know what you mean, where you kind of zone out and your eyes are still going, but what you're doing by transcribing it is really slowing it down and making your body and the mechanism of your mind like process the building blocks of the story.
Yeah. And it makes me a weird participant in it. It's an odd feeling. I don't know if I would say, hey, I recommend everybody go and just, you know, say if you love the jaunt, go and just do that from word one. But you know, it might
That's
actually
terrible.
really help, like, you focus on the rhythm of the narrative, like, you know, and that kind of thing. And there's also some really weird thing about doing it that way too, where I'm like the same words coming out of my fingers or the same words that came out of Stephen King's fingers. And I don't know, I was a weird little King obsessed kid. So but I've always loved the story. And then, you know, I was around when the movie came out. That's when I was very actively doing, you know, working in the entertainment reporting world. I spent 2 weeks on the set, you know, of the movie,
Wow.
and you know, I tried to talk Darabont into letting me be one of the people in the grocery store, and he told me I could before they started shooting, and then I think he forgot that promise, and but I still got to visit, so I didn't get to be one of the background people that flocked to Miss
Sure,
Carpenter.
Eric, go stand over here in the mist.
Y'all, no, yeah, I am the Mist. I do play the Mist in Frank Darabont's The Mist. I don't know if you know this, so
Amazing.
but yeah,
I
I love
remember
her
when the
story.
movie came out, it was fitting. It was like, and I'm pretty sure I saw it opening night, and it was Thanksgiving. Because I remember, like, there was this funny fitting bookend of like leaving my mom's house to go see this movie that she definitely would not have approved of, and didn't approve of the story, back in the day. And I remember how excited I was to see it, but also, and what's funny too is that I remember I like looked up the credits and everything, and I was like, oh fuck, it's the guy who wrote the Blob remake. This is gonna be great. And that was how I framed it for myself. Like I knew he had done Shawshank and all that, but like I was like, it was the Blob that was the standout for me. And it's one of the most memorable movie going experiences of my whole life. Only because obviously the movie was very intense, and I thought it was brilliant. But the most memorable thing was at the basically, which is very different from the novella. You could hear a fucking pin drop when that ending hit. And then one lone guy in the back of the theater went, fuck. The whole audience just burst out laughing because everyone needed it. It was like everyone needed the release because it was just fucking blackest, darkest, impossible. Like I was like, oh my God, how did he get away with it? Holy
That's an
shit.
ending that King himself has said he wishes he had thought of. He was very
Like
proud of.
it's amazing. It's
It's
just fucking amazing.
bleak, but it's meaningful too because he gives up hope and they give up hope and he kills he executes them rather than
Look at my
face,
son.
face what's out there. But all throughout the movie, whenever someone is brave and smart, not when they're brave and stupid, when they just run out into the mist, but the people who say, like, there's a little cadre that gets together and goes out and they survive. We see them later. They made it. And but when you give up hope, when you lose hope and give in to fear, that's when the bad things get you. So
Yeah, it's true. And it feels like it is one of those stories that just, I don't know, it hits you different in different times. And obviously now is an interesting time to either read that story or see the movie because you're like, oh.
It's funny because the story is very political on the page, right? You know, you get a lot of King's say distaste and distrust of religious people, or overly religious people, we should say. As you mentioned earlier, zealots, that's a great term. But there's also kind of a cynical bent in humanity's ability to grapple with a situation like this. You do have, just like in the movie, some people opt for suicide. Some people can't face what's going on. Some people will see proof in front of their face and go, you know, like, I still don't believe this, right? And it's like, yeah, it's kind of, well, that's the thing, is what's interesting to me about this is that was kind of on the page, but it still has that King sinister, optimism that happens at the end, right? Where it's a cliffhanger ending. Or I guess not cliffhanger. It's left to be ambiguous. Like, we don't know if
Points
they're
of
going to find it, but
ellipses,
there's a
right?
glimmer of
Glimmer of
hope.
hope.
There is hope. There is hope there, right? Darabont chose to not do that, and at the time he was responding to the neocon movement from the George W. Bush era. And what's crazy about it is at that time it was just like, that's radical, but we could get there someday. We're living in that day, baby. This is like, you know, the Darabont version, the uber cynical, you know, you can't trust humans as a group because they will always make the wrong decisions. And they, you know, it's like all that stuff that read to me as a little cynical, but maybe as a warning of things, you know, to come. Like now it just reads like this is now. This is, you know, of course, people, you know, you mentioned COVID, having lived through COVID, this is not, you know, seeing how we went through that and the reaction to it was to essentially go, all right, I'm sorry, we made you wear masks and, you know, don't raid our federal buildings anymore. It's like what the fuck? Like, I don't understand kind of where we are as a kind of broken society, but, you know, at the moment. And I think a lot of it just makes the mist look like a fucking seer, you know, of, you know, predictor of kind of. Kind of where we were going as a country.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. So. King really hates hypocrites. You know, yes. I think he grew up knowing a lot of those holier than thou types, like Carrie White's mom, you know, very judgmental, who also probably are not perfect, right? Carrie came from somewhere and she doesn't have a dad. So yeah. Mrs. White must have been stepping out with somebody.
And she liked it. Yeah. But, she did. That's her words. Yeah.
He's real down on hypocrites and holier than thou people. And I think that's it's a good instinct because those people are terrible.
And I like how noisy he is about it to this day.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's great. I think he's such a badass.
Well, it's so funny. Like looking at him, like politically, you know, with he, because I remember there was a period of time where he was trying to like give Elon Musk the benefit of the doubt, where he's just right. like, I drive a Tesla. He's like, I like my car and whatever. Yeah. He's like, I don't think you're good for this. And then it just Elon kept pushing it and was so needy for his attention. I don't know if you remember all that that stuff on Twitter where he just daily it felt like Elon Musk would be trying to either jab at King or try to get him his approval somehow. It's so fucking weird, that whole thing. And then ultimately King's like, fuck this place. I'm heading to Threads and Blue Sky.
Yeah. So great. I think a lot of people were giving him the benefit of the doubt for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it is a sad, you know, fall. We don't need to make this all about Elon Musk. Too much of this fucking world's about Elon Musk right now. But you know, it is a sad thing where, you know, for a while he was like positioned as the, you know, the kind of the, he cared about environmental stuff, he cared about, you know, progressing into space and exploration and all that stuff, and now it feels like he's shying away from all that. It's like, you know, I don't know, it's like he just went full right wing, and I don't know if it's a power grab, if it's self-preservational, if it's his deeply held personal beliefs. I don't know. I just, you know, that dude's a conundrum to me, and not in a good way.
Amen.
So yeah, let's talk about the mist some more. No more Elon Musk. Do you think that if you found yourself in this situation, if you were, you know, in a grocery store and this mist rolls in, how quickly are you a believer in the supernatural explanation versus the real life stuff? Do you think being like a horror fan has kind of primed you to, if this happened in real life, you just adapt instantly? Or does that make you more,
I don't know.
This is like what would happen in a movie. So this can't be happening in real life.
I don't think it would be an instant
thing,
but I would be inclined to be open-minded about that possibility, you know, and to believe it more than maybe others. It's funny, when I was working on the in the paranormal franchise, I remember on I think it was the third movie, the studio brought in a like a parapsychologist or an expert, you know, from some department at UCLA, and I remember sitting and chatting with him about, you know, his work and whatnot. And he said that his job first and foremost is to enter every home as a skeptic. And so he said that when he would have a case, you know, like someone say, hey, I'm being haunted or, you know, whatever, he would always meet them in public like at a Denny's, and he would have like a coffee with them. And he said that was to evaluate their mental health. So he was evaluating them first.
Right.
Then when he would go to their home, if he felt like they passed that test, he would go to their home and then he would ask for them to stay outside so that he could have 30 minutes to an hour to walk their house. And they thought he was doing it to like feel the spirit, you know, or whatever. But he said he was going around looking for anything that would make noises, like, you know, doors that weren't properly like secured or loose air vents that would rattle, or like he literally was testing the home for like just reasonable things that could go, that could make sounds or scare people or whatever. And so it's funny that someone who believed deeply in the supernatural still approached everything with a very strong, healthy dose of skepticism first, because I think he was suspicious of people, not ghosts. And their motivations. And so I think in a situation like that, yeah, I think I would be evaluating the people first a little bit, and then kind of figuring out a little bit of what's happening out there and how this could be going on. I mean, look, if a giant wall of mist surrounded my grocery store and then people started getting sucked out into the night screaming or into the mist, I would probably think something very bad is happening that is not of this earth. But yeah, I don't know. It's funny, like people, you don't know how you're going to react to things, you know, like extreme things. You know, you might think I'm the, like, it's so funny. Like, I always feel like people think like I would be so strong. Like, I would be like, I would keep my shit together if like some, you know, and then they're usually the first person to unravel.
Oh yeah.
So it's like, I don't know.
I remember seeing there was, you remember the terrible nightmarish Las Vegas shooting, the guy was shooting down from the
Oh, fuck.
hotel into the
The
crowd.
worst.
There was a guy in the audience who's one of these YouTube gun nuts, you know, big beefy muscular guy who's always shooting guns and talking about rising up revolution or some bullshit, and he ran, he just ran like a chicken, just booked out of there. You know, there are people taking cell phone videos and you see this guy just
Just
hightailing
booking.
it.
Yeah, he's not one of the people like trying to save other people or
He's not the good guy with a gun in that
No,
situation. Yeah.
pushing
No.
people out of the way, you know, whatever. Like, it's just couldn't, just leaves that Wile E. Coyote trail of dust.
Totally.
Yeah, gets out of
Well,
there.
it reminds me of seeing all the January 6th people, you know, during January, all the GOP lawmakers that were the second shit started happening. Like they were like throwing up the Josh Hawleys or whatever, throwing up the support, you know, signs to the crowd before all that. And then once they started breaching, like there's just a dust shadow, a smoke shadow of what their outline was as they're running for cover.
And then you hear, you contrastly, you hear the story of the you know, like the 5 foot tall school principal who charges the school shooter, you know, and gives her life to save some other students and save some kids, like, or you know, the older gym coach who does that. You know, it's always the people that you would
Well, the
expect to
hypocrites,
be,
or this is what King talks about. Same shit. It's like the people who, you know, like are pro-life and, you know, protecting, you know, this itty bitty tiny cell of a person, but as soon as they're born, they don't give a fuck about them.
George
They don't.
Carlin's got a great bit about that. They're
They don't take. They don't want to take care of anybody.
pro birth, not pro life. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, to pull
No.
it back to the drop, did
Yeah.
you feel you did that, or not
Now
the drop
that
again?
we've
Drop.
gotten about four more 1-star reviews from angry Republicans listening to this
I know, right?
Know, pull it back to drop. Your environment, again, I don't want to give away what happens, but you have characters who help, you have characters who are just sort of what the fuck is going on, and those who are looking out for themselves. Did you feel you were creating that, those textures in your background characters and supporting characters of the people who step up for you and the people who don't?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that you definitely get a feel, again, trying to stay out of spoiler territory. But yeah, I think that we were looking to figure out who, where we could sort of create heroes and allies, but also still disguise them, you know, and keep them questionable as well. And what's kind of fun about that is that someone who is actually trying to help might seem even more suspicious because they're trying to help.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Yeah.
again, all in service of that particular plot and situation.
One character I can see in either story is your waiter, who brings a lot of comic relief to the story too.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about him, how you envisioned
He
him?
was someone who, again, I felt like that classic, like you've had that guy before. I also really, you know, sometimes I like to, I don't know, weaponize humor, or use it to a certain kind of effect, because the movie sort of forces you to exist in a very sort of constant state of anxiety, and no audience member can stay there forever, much less an hour and a half. A tight 90, as they like to say. And so for me, that character was the release valve, you know, like it just gives the audience a chance to kind of like get some of that out, and then we're back into the plot. And so, but also, yes, I mean, because he's so hapless and jovial and dopey, that like you kind of it, you can almost question, like, is this a big act? You know what I
Yeah,
mean?
I
For
mean,
sure.
we don't want to say he's,
We don't know. We
you know where he
don't
goes, but
know.
his facade at least is the absolute worst thing you could expect. He presents himself at least as a waiter who's also an improv wannabe. And
And he
I could
always
see
shows up at the worst times, and like,
I could see him in the grocery store just like workshopping his bit
totally. He's there. He's
while
there for
people are getting
sure.
yanked out by tentacles, you know.
Yeah, he's definitely there for sure.
Do you have a favorite creature from The Mist? Is there something that jumps out to you as like either something like that would really get to you?
I mean, anything spider,
Yeah.
anything like that, I have a huge fear of spiders. I'm still very much afraid of, like, I will run out of a room.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of stuff really gets me. So, like, I it's funny, like the giant Lovecraftian, like, massive things don't, weirdly, because they're so outside of our human experience,
Yeah.
that they're, I find those things to be harder to be afraid of, funny enough, than the smaller things that I think I can somehow, my brain recognizes and makes more real to
Well,
me.
it's the smaller things in this story are the ones that seemed out to get you. Like that, there's something existentially terrifying about the behemoth, because it doesn't give a fuck about you, and you're like, you're such a small, it cares
You're a
about you
speck.
in
You're
the
an ant.
same way that you care about this anthill that's, you know,
Exactly.
in the lawn as you're walking by. It's like you don't even give it a second thought. Yet it's the little things, the little stinger bug and the spiders with human fucking teeth and shit, you know, those are the things out to get you.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's true. It's very true.
Do you have a favorite, Anthony, on those?
I like the tentacles that come in through the garage door in the
Yeah.
back. You know, I
Those
always
are
thought that was a cool scene. So that's the one I would throw out there.
Is there anything else you want to touch on with the mist before we let you go?
Well, no, I mean, I feel like we've covered it.
Covered. Cool.
We've covered it. We've
Hell
covered
yeah.
it. We've
Corners and spots and things.
Probed your childhood. We've found
I
your dad hiding in the pages of it.
know.
That was a real, that's so good. I love that you found
We revealed that childhood video game that has been
Ghosts and
Goblins.
Goblins. You go
Yeah.
pull that up, play it. Now you can play it to your heart's content.
And
Love it.
we've dropped another whole star rating on iTunes with all the
Sorry.
political talk,
That,
but
that's my
it's all right.
fault. Just
No.
good luck with Drop, man. Best of
Thank
luck as
you.
it rolls out into the world.
I know I'm a nervous wreck about it, but yeah, we'll see.
People, it's a great date movie, I
It's
gotta
it is. It's a good great
say.
and it's also, may I
Just
say,
stay
it's
off your phone.
yeah, may I also say it's kind of nostalgic for me, because it feels like, and this might be a good place to end off on, it feels like it wasn't that long ago when we would get these kind of high concept thrillers out of the studio system a few times a year, and now it feels like it's an anomaly, not just to be made, but to be made and put on the big screen. Like, I could see this kind of movie is what goes to Apple TV and stuff now, right? It's like,
no, it's true. It's very hard to get this kind of stuff in theaters, and I really wanted to make something that felt like a 90s thriller,
yeah,
you know, that also still had modern flourishes and modern technology. But yeah, I mean, they are, it's everyone's still trying to figure out like what is theatrical worthy now.
In the 90s, it would be science fiction. People would be like, what?
I know.
You have cameras in your house? You could drop just texts and videos?
Yeah. I know. It's crazy. But yeah, I'm excited for people to see it.
Yeah, well, we're excited for it too, and best of luck with the movie, and we'll talk to you next time.
Awesome. So, thanks again, guys. It's good to see you.
Great talking to you.
Many thanks to Christopher Landon for his return engagement to the KingCast. I think we decided not to call him a two-timer because that has too many negative connotations there. I always have a lot of fun when he comes on the show, and so he needs to keep making some cool movies, so we have an excuse to bring him back time and time again. The next episode of the KingCast will drop on April 23rd, and the guest is someone in a million years I never would have thought would have been on the show. Thankfully, Bresnikan had the bright idea of reaching out, and he ended up agreeing to come on. So, who am I talking about? If you're a child of the 80s, like I am, you know the name Larry Hama. He's a comic book author and the man most directly responsible for building out the lore for G.I. Joe in the comic books, on the toys. He wrote most of the dossier stuff. And so if you ever collected G.I. Joe in the 80s and you read with great interest all the stats and stuff on the back, Larry wrote them. So this is the guy that kind of developed the mystery behind Snake Eyes. G.I. Joe, as you know it, is pretty much all at his feet. I'm sure he would share the credit, and then, you know, there's lots of talented people that worked on G.I. Joe back in the day. But I would say the man most directly responsible for the G.I. Joe of the 80s, the Joes versus Cobra and all that fun stuff, is Mr. Larry Hama. Turns out he's also a big Stephen King fan, and he collaborated with King and King's then 12-year-old son, Owen, back in the 80s to create a character known as Crystal Ball. Yeah, I don't know if you remember this guy. He had a little holographic hypno shield. Anyway, we talked to Larry about collaborating with King and Owen on that. We talk a bit about the legacy of G.I. Joe, the legacy of his work there, and also about his own King fandom. We kind of structure a lot of it on Salem's Lot, which is the book that he read that kind of hooked him on Stephen King. So it's a very fun chat, and that drops on Wednesday, April 23rd. And don't forget to sign up for the KingCast Patreon. It's the best way to support the show, and you'll get access to a ton of never-before-released episodes into the main feed, talking commentaries, all sorts of shenanigans. You know the drill by now. Patreon.com/theKingCast. Throw us a few bucks, and we'll make it worth your while. Till next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.